Well, we'll be looking on Wednesday evenings about the missing gift, the ways in which we can use the gift of God in order to be able to help one another. And as we've gone through the scriptures, we've looked at different ways in which we're able to do that. The common theme has been ways in which through our speech we can all benefit other people. We know that we can do that through our actions. I don't want to minimize that side of things, of course, but my emphasis in this little series, I've been doing so through what we say. We've looked at, over the course of the series, we've looked at comforting one another. I've been able to do that. So 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 11, for example, therefore comfort each other and edify one another, just as you also are doing. We've looked at teaching. You might remember from Deuteronomy 6 and verse 7. The way in which we should particularly teach our children. But we also looked at some New Testament references that talked about teaching one another. We've looked at admonishing. So in Romans chapter 15 and verse 14, for example, we read, I'm confident concerning you, my brethren, that you also are full of goodness, filled with all knowledge, able to admonish one another. We've looked at singing. So we've obviously been doing that already this evening, but singing not just to God, but to one another. Ephesians 5 and verse 19, speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. You might remember as we looked at those passages, we looked at how they combined our singing to the Lord, but also our singing to one another, that our singing is both horizontal and vertical. And then, of course, we've also looked at prophesying from 1 Corinthians 14, verse 1, where Paul says that he wants them to desire the gift of prophecy. So we've looked at all of these different things, all ways in which all of us, not just some of us, but all of us can be of benefit to one another. And through these gifts that the Lord has given to us. And I don't know how you've responded to the series and the things that we've been looking at, but I always worry that when we look at a series like this, or we're looking at ways in which we can do things in particular, there's a danger in which it's overwhelming, and maybe that's how you felt. So as we draw this to a close, and obviously we're coming up to Christmas and to New Year, I want to taking a big picture view again, looking at these different things, and think, well, what is it really that the Lord is calling to, and crucially, how do we then do that? So two verses particularly we're going to be looking at this evening, and the first one is 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 14. So we'll have time there, and then a little bit of time in Colossians later on. So it's page 1050 if you want to look it up in a church Bible. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 14. We exhort you, brethren, warn those who are unruly, comfort the faint-hearted, uphold the weak, be patient with all. Warn those who are unruly, comfort the faint-hearted, uphold the weak, be patient with all. Now, there's perhaps in verse 14 a mixture of things that we would say, possibly also things that we would do. Obviously, patience in particular is something that we do. But I think all of these things are linked together with the way that we speak. Certainly warning and comforting, probably also upholding, are to do with the way that we speak. And the simple point that I want to make from 1 Thessalonians 5 verse 14 is really obvious, and you didn't need to come to prayer meeting tonight to learn what I'm about to tell you, but it is worth emphasizing, and that's this. Everyone is different, and therefore everybody needs to be treated differently. That's the simple thing. Everybody is different, and therefore everybody needs to be treated differently. So some people, according to Paul here in Thessalonians, some people are unruly. I won't ask you whether you think we've got anyone in Bethel who meets that criteria of unruly. I certainly won't ask you to name names if you think there are. But for people who are unruly, there's a clear direction that's given for how we should have people who are unruly. They are to be warned. Now let me emphasize again, okay, this is a message, a letter, that is not written to the pastor of the church. It is not written to the elders of the church. It is written to the church. You can see that from 1 Thessalonians chapter 1 and 1, to the church of the Thessalonians in God the Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. There obviously are New Testament letters that are written to individual people, to church leaders, for example, church. And actually the verses before make that clear to us. We urge you, brethren, to recognize those who labor among you and who are over you in the Lord and admonish you, and to esteem them highly in love for their work's sake. So in verses 12 and 13, it's really clear there, isn't it, that Paul is speaking to the whole church, telling the whole church how they should treat their leaders. And he calls the whole church then in verse 12, brethren. So when he says in verse 14, now we exhort you, brethren, which is almost identical to what he said at the beginning of verse 12, we urge you, it seems very, very likely, to say the least, that he's talking to the same group of people. So he's not saying, look, church leaders warn those who are unruly. He's saying, church, warn those who are unruly. Church, comfort the faint-hearted. Church, uphold the weak. Church, be patient with all. Now, it may look different, perhaps, if a leader does it to a member of a congregation. This is a command that the Lord, through Paul, is given to the whole church. And indeed, that has been the emphasis in this whole section. We looked right at the beginning, where I started, in 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 11, comfort each other and edify one another, just as you are also doing. This is the whole emphasis in this section, that this is something the church does for one another. Now, you might feel uncomfortable about warning those who are unruly, and I understand that. I would feel a little bit uncomfortable about that myself. We're naturally, perhaps, reticent to wade in. But, of course, Paul here isn't suggesting we do wade in with a big stick and start batter people who are unruly, because, of course, that would be unruly ourselves, isn't it? We don't solve a problem of unruliness by ourselves unruly. But he is saying that actually we need to take responsibility. He is saying that we need to be able to care for and support one another, and that God has given us the gifts to do that. He's given us the commands to do that, and warning those who are unruly is part of that. Now, what might that look like in practice? It's difficult to perhaps give an example, and even if I did give an example, it's unlikely that exactly that situation might arise. But could there not be a situation, perhaps, where somebody, maybe without even realizing, is creating dissension and trouble, that maybe he's not willing to go along with things for the sake of others? And could it not be in that circumstance that someone older, perhaps, or someone who's particularly got a good relationship with that person might not put their arm around them and say, hey, you know, brother, I appreciate you very much for your enthusiasm and your passion, but actually we're all in this together, and we should do this together. And it may be that you don't like what we're just talking about, but for the sake of others, can you not go along with this? Worth it? To warn those who are unruly is one of the things that we're called to do. But also in verse 14, we're to comfort the faint-hearted. Now, this is something very different, isn't it? This is the emphasis I want to make. Comforting is very different from warning. We're not to warn everyone. The implication, we're not to comfort everyone. Some people are going to need to be warned. Some people are going to need to be comforted, and we need to treat these different people differently. And there are some people who are faint-hearted, who are timid, who are anxious. If you warn someone who's timid and anxious and faint-hearted, you very likely make the problem worse, won't you? They'll be even more anxious. So what are we to do? Well, something entirely different with those folk. We're to comfort them. Perhaps we find ourselves more comfortable, if I can use that word, to do this kind of thing rather than to warn, to comfort the faint-hearted. I know some of you make a real effort particularly to do this and have almost a ministry of comfort, an area perhaps where we find, some of us at least, find it easier perhaps to do. You see, it's easy sometimes to be critical of those who are anxious or timid or faint-hearted, but there's none of that here, is there? There's no critical spirit. There's no judging. No, in that situation, if someone is feeling that way, we're to comfort. And there's a really lovely balance here in all of these things. There's a big debate in society. If people want to live in a certain way, we should accept that. If people want to identify as a certain gender, we should accept that. That's what we're all being told. Accept people as they are. There's a problem with that view, of course, if you take it too far. The problem with that view is maybe it's not a good place to be where you are. Maybe actually the person themselves might not particularly want to be there. So what does the New Testament teach us, at least here and in many other similar passages? Well, we're to deal with people as they are. We're to be gentle or to be firm, whatever the need is at the time. But we're not to leave people where they are. Can you understand that? We're to deal with people where they are, but we're not to leave them where they are. And maybe at the moment our society makes the mistake of, well, we deal with people where we are, but then we leave them there. We don't really seek to help them particularly. And maybe in a previous generation, we were so committed to getting people out of where they were that we really weren't very sympathetic at all. And if someone suffered from depression or anxiety or so on, perhaps they felt they couldn't speak about it or whatever else it may be. Perhaps we've gone too far the other way, but Scripture gets the balance just right. Deals with people where they are, but it doesn't leave them where they are. And when we think about it, that's exactly how the Lord dealt with us, isn't it? He dealt with us as we were. We were what? Sinners? Rebels? And yet the Lord reached into our lives. He dealt with us as we are, but he didn't leave us as sinners and rebels. He rescued us. He redeemed us. That's what the gospel does. The gospel deals with people as they are, but it doesn't leave them as they are. And so should our model be. So we're to comfort, warn those who are unruly, comfort the faint-hearted, uphold the weak. Now again, it would be easy to be critical and judgmental here. Maybe we fall into that trap. Maybe we feel other people have judged us for the things where we are weak. But we are all weak, aren't we? We are all weak. And what do the weak need? Do the weak need to be try harder to do better? Sort yourself out? That's not at all what's said here, is it? No, what are we to do? We're to uphold the weak. Because sometimes when we're struggling, we can't, at least initially, help ourselves. Or at least we're already doing all we can do to help ourselves, and we feel we can't do any more. And someone coming along then and perhaps warning us, telling us what we should do, is actually maybe the very worst thing that could happen, because then we feel even more inadequate and even more weak. Now, what Paul is saying here is if somebody is weak, well, they need somebody alongside them. They need somebody to help, to uphold, to keep them going. Someone, as it were, who can stop them from drowning. That's what the weak need. And that's what we as believers ought to do for those who are weak. Now again, this is about dealing with people where they are. It's not about leaving them where they are. So we don't want to be in a situation where we're permanently somebody else's crutch. That's not the job that God has given to anyone. We might need to temporarily be that while the Lord deals with someone and helps them to be stronger. So as we uphold the weak, we're not, as it were, if you can, don't mind the metaphor, taking all of their weight. The Lord alone can do that. But we are putting an arm alongside so that they can lean on our shoulder. And as they limp along, as it were, we limp along with them and we uphold them. And over time, as God works his grace in them, we trust that they will strengthen, and maybe in a year or two's time, they'll be upholding us in our weakness. We're to deal with people as they are, but not leave them where they are. And then finally, in verse 14, we're to be patient with all. You see, although I've been emphasizing here that we need to treat different people differently, and of course you can see that in the text and you know that for yourself, it's equally true that there are some things, particularly the fruit of the Spirit, for example, there are some things that we just ought to be able to demonstrate widely and broadly and to everyone. Now, again, I'm not going to ask you to name names or to give a score or anything like that, but it's fair to say that there are some people it's easier to be patient with than others. And if this verse just said, well, be patient with most, we could probably all manage that really quite easily, because most of the people we meet are great and they're fine. The real patience is for the one or two, isn't it, who really get our goat. And maybe that will be different for different ones of us. Some people that maybe you get on really well with, the person sitting next to you might really struggle with. And vice versa, of course. But we're to be patient with everybody. Why are we to be patient with everybody? Well, because everybody will fall short. And everybody, in different ways, will rub somebody up the wrong way. Everybody will upset somebody, and therefore we need to be patient with everyone. And as we again reflect back on all four of these things, but particularly perhaps with this last one of patience, we recognize again that this is exactly how the Lord treated us. If the Lord was not patient with us, not one of us would be here tonight, would we? If the Lord wasn't patient, if he'd have what? Given us 1,000 sins and then called it a day, none of us would be sitting here. 10,000 sins, none of us would be sitting here. But for most of us, probably years and years and years of hearing the gospel before we responded. Years and years and years of rebellion. And God, in his patience, waited and waited and waited and waited. And yet it's an area that we sometimes struggle with. But in church life, as in all other types of life, we need to be patient with everyone. So we've looked at 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 14, and I'm seeking to make the point that we need to treat different people differently. I'm looking to make the point that this is how the Lord has treated us. And yet I said a little while ago that maybe before we even got to this verse, you perhaps feel a little bit overwhelmed. More to do. How do we do this? What's the practicalities? We've got to know people. We've got to know whether they're unruly or faint-hearted or weak. We've got to have these qualities to be able to warn and to comfort and uphold and be patient. How's that even possible? Well, Colossians chapter 4 and verse 16 may help us perhaps with that. Just a few pages earlier, page 1048. I've given you the wrong verse, haven't I? I said Colossians 4, verse 16, and I'm wrong about that. I'm wondering if it's 3:16, but it's not. That's what I was reading, but it's not 3:16. That was from an earlier part. It's 6. Colossians 4 verse 6. There we are. Colossians 4 verse 6. Sorry, my writing's let me down. Colossians chapter 4 verse 6, page 1047. So how do we do this? Well, actually, let's begin at verse 2. It ends verse 6 is where it ends, but verse 2 is where it begins. So Colossians chapter 4 and verse 2, continue earnestly in prayer. being vigilant in it with thanksgiving. So as Paul is sort of bringing his book of Colossians to an end, he wants to encourage the people to pray. And of course, that's why we've come here tonight, to continue earnestly in prayer. And if we don't have that foundation of prayer, then we will be overwhelmed by the things that the Lord calls us to do. Because if we don't have that foundation of prayer, we'll end up thinking, this is all on me. I've got to be somebody who is able to admonish. I've got to be someone who can warn. I've got to be someone who can comfort. I've got to be someone who can uphold. I've got to be someone who is patient. And I'm not those things, and maybe you're not those things either. But when we continue earnestly in prayer, it reminds us, of course, that none of us are those things. And Paul himself wasn't that by his nature. But he was that by the way that God worked in him. And of course, what Paul is calling us to do is to depend on God and to look to God. And one of the reasons why the Bible often gives us impossible things to do is precisely to remind us of our need of God and our own weakness. So that sense of being overwhelmed is a good thing to think, if it directs our hearts back to the Lord. And that's what Paul is doing here. Continue earnestly in prayer, being vigilant in it. We need the grace of God working in our lives if we are to live out a holy Christian life. We can't do it on our own. One of the sessions that we had earlier in this series was our need for the Spirit's power and for wisdom, you may remember. And this is another example of that. So much so of our need for prayer that in verses 3 and 4 of Colossians chapter 4, Paul talks about his need for prayer. So he talks about continue earnestly in prayer for the Colossians, and while you're doing that, pray also for us, that God would open to us a door for the word to speak the mystery of Christ, for which I'm also in chains. So verse 3 there, Paul is saying, look, pray that I would have opportunities to speak the gospel even though I'm in prison. So maybe normally there was a sense in which Paul could kind of create his own opportunities. He could go to the marketplace or the street corners and he could create his own opportunities to a certain extent, but he's in prison now. He's very restricted. So he's praying that God would open a door for the word even when he's kind of locked behind the door. Now that's easy to understand how Paul in that circumstance might need prayer for opportunities. But look at verse 4. He doesn't just pray for opportunities, but he also prays that he'd make the most of the opportunities. Can you see that? That I may make it manifest. Or to put it more clearly, I may make it clear as I ought to speak. You see, Paul the Apostle, the one who's been used of God, inspired by God to write many, many books of the New Testament, including books like Romans, that great, clear, wonderful gospel exposition, needs this little church in Colossae to pray for him that when he gets an opportunity to speak for Christ, he would make the gospel clear. That passage, that verse has been encouragement to preachers everywhere because we think, well, if Paul needed help to make the gospel clear, how much more do we need help to make the gospel clear? So he ought to speak clearly, but he still needs prayer that he would. And verse 4, I think, actually really helps us, doesn't it? We ought to do those things we've been talking about already. We ought to warn those who are unruly. We ought to comfort the faint-hearted. We ought to uphold the weak. We ought to be patient with all. We ought to do these things. But actually, unless we pray, and crucially, unless others pray for us, then we won't be able to do any of those things. Because prayer is critical. And that's, of course, one of the reasons why we come together in a meeting like this. And as we continue to look at Colossians 4 again and verses 2 through to 6, we see that this is all heading towards verse 6. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. So how do you know how you should speak to an unruly brother? How do you know how to comfort a faint-hearted sister? How do you know how to uphold a weak believer? How do you know how to do that? How do you know the right words in the right moment to the right person? How do you know that? And one of the things that Paul seems to be saying here in verse 6 is, well, if you always speak graciously, if your speech is always seasoned with salt, we'll look at what that means in a minute, then you'll know. In other words, the secret is not to switch into a helping people mode. Here's somebody who's unruly. I will rebuke them. Here's somebody who is faint-hearted. Twist the dial. I will comfort them. If that's our mindset and our attitude, well, we'll actually never be able to do it. Because what Paul is saying here in verse 6, that if we live in this prayer-filled life, asking for God's help, then we'll be able to allow our speech always, all of our speech, always to be filled with grace. As the grace of God, in other words, comes into our lives, the grace of God will come out of our mouths. And our speech will always be with grace. And it's only if our speech is always with grace that we will be able to speak the right word at the right time, in the right situation, to the right person. God will, well, through the work of the Spirit in us and the prayers of others and ourselves, he can do that for us. But not only is our speech always to be with grace, it's to be seasoned with salt. Commentators do scratch their head a little bit as to exactly what Paul meant, and I understand why, because I can't tell you exactly what Paul meant, but I do think we can have a pretty good stab at it. We can think especially perhaps of what salt was used for in ancient times. It had two main purposes. In our own day, it tends to only have one purpose, doesn't it? In our house, that's chips. That's the only purpose of salt in our house, is chips. Flavor, in other words, flavor. That's one of the main reasons that we use salt today. We also know, of course, that salt is good for us, don't we, in moderation. But in ancient days, salt was used not just for flavor, but much more as a preservative. They didn't, of course, have freezers or fridges, and it was a very hot around the Middle East, and therefore salt was pretty much the only preservative they really had. So if there is a thinking around salt, then preservative is going to be the thing that's going to leap into the minds of the church in Colossae or anyone else at the time. So with this preservative, let your speech always be with grace, with a preservative added, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. How does that help us? Well, it seems to me that what Paul is saying here is that, let's imagine you had a chunk of meat, and it's out in the heat. It doesn't take long, does it? Even in the winter here, if you leave a bacon slice or something on the side, it won't be long before it starts to discolor and change and what have you. And of course, salt slows that down. The more salt you have, then the slower that process will be. It doesn't eliminate it entirely, but it does slow it down. It stops it being rotten. And salt, therefore, has this very much this sense of purity and keeping things pure. So if we have purity in our speech, and that's perhaps the seasoning that Paul is primarily talking about here, if we have this purity, it will stop our speech going bad. Have you ever had the situation where you've kind of said something, but maybe you were a bit grumpy at the time, maybe you just weren't being as thoughtful as you might have been, and it just came out wrong? Well, I think partly what Paul is saying here is that if we have this aim for purity and care when we're speaking, that our speech is always therefore with grace, that sort of mistake won't happen, or at least will happen much less frequently. We'll be able to know when it's right to comfort, and on the other hand, right to rebuke. We'll know when we need to speak gently with somebody and when we need to speak firmly. But we can, as I've said, only do this if our speech is always like that. So in all of what I've been saying over this whole series really is not that, I don't know, at 11:30 on a Sunday, 11:45 on a Sunday, we could kind of slip into, let's my speech be helpful, and for the next 15 minutes try and find different people and speak the right thing into those people, and then we go home and we turn the switch off and we go back and scream at the cat and whatever else we might do. That's obviously not what the Lord is calling us to. And if we live like that, well, we might be able to fake it for a few Sundays, but that's all it will be. But if our whole lives are dedicated to try and speak gently and winsomely with grace into every situation, whether we're speaking to somebody who's just been bereaved or whether we're ringing up the gas board to try and work out why they've overcharged us for 200 quid, but if we speak with grace, seasoned with his purity in every situation, leaning on the Lord, continuing earnestly in prayer, that we may speak clearly and demonstrate the gospel, then we'll find, yeah, actually those Sunday conversations suddenly become a lot easier and suddenly become a lot more Christ-centered. And this goes back then to what we were looking at earlier in the series, Colossians 3:16. I'll finish with this. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another. That's what it comes back to, doesn't it? When Christ's word is dwelling in us, then we will be able to give out Christ's word to others. If our prayers and our emphasis are only on what we give out, then we'll never be able to do that. But if our desires and our pleas with the Lord are for what we would receive in order that we might give, then there's this constant supply, isn't there, to meet the demands. And if you ever feel worn out of just trying to always speak the best and in supportive and helpful ways and thinking about what the right thing to say is, if that wears you out, then what you need is more of the word of Christ. What I need is more of the word of Christ dwelling in me richly in all wisdom, that I might be able to teach and admonish and sing with grace in my heart to the Lord. So can you pray that for me as a preacher, particularly thinking of the Christmas services, but by no means limited to that? What I need is the word of Christ dwelling in me richly. And when I have that in its fullness, you will be able to see that in the way that I speak. But equally, that's what you need too, for the ways in which you seek to speak for Christ in this world. You too need the word of Christ dwelling in you richly in all wisdom, that our speech may be with grace and seasoned with salt. Let's pray that for one another even this evening.